For years, many education officials and parents in Arizona have argued the state doesn't spend enough money on K-12 schools. And a few days ago, a Maricopa County Superior Court judge officially agreed. I'm Steve Goldstein. On today's Here and Now, we'll talk about Judge Catherine Cooper's ruling and what it forces the governor and lawmakers to do. Does it mean a special session is around the corner? We'll also look at Arizona's K-12 funding formula. Plus, Arizona's Attorney General Tom Horn is under investigation for alleged campaign finance violations. There have also been questions about his personal conduct. Horn apparently has nothing on Utah's Attorney General's office, though, as two of that state's most recent attorneys general were arrested yesterday. I'll talk with a Utah journalist about the latest. Also, summer can be a strange time for dining around the valley. Howard Seftel of the Arizona Republic will talk about the latest trends and how business is going in these hot months. Here and Now is next on KJZZ. The news is first. This is KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Coming up this hour, though it seems like Arizona's Attorney General Tom Horn is facing a lot of trouble, it pales in comparison to a pair of Utah's recent attorneys general who were arrested yesterday on corruption-related charges. I'll talk with a Utah reporter who's been closely following the story. Governor Jan Brewer has passionate supporters and opponents and has found herself in the midst of controversies like SB 1070, while also pushing for a tax increase to fund education. So where's Brewer on Phoenix Magazine's ranking of Arizona governors? I'll ask editor Craig Outier. Also, summer dining in the valley has changed a lot over the years. So what's thriving and what are some new trends? I'll talk with Arizona Republic restaurant critic Howard Seftel. We start today's program with a ruling by Maricopa County Superior Court Judge Catherine Cooper. It would require Governor Brewer and the legislature to come up with an extra $316 million immediately and potentially $2.9 billion over 5 years to make up for aid to schools they illegally withheld starting in 2009. A 2000 voter-approved measure hiked the sales tax by 0.6 cents and required the state to boost aid to schools each year to account for inflation. That occurred until the governor and lawmakers concluded they didn't have the money to spend. The Supreme Court ruled last year the law had been broken, sending the case to Judge Catherine Cooper to figure out how much schools are owed. She ordered state aid reset to what it would have been had the law been obeyed all along. Later this hour, we'll find out whether a special legislative session might have to happen to figure out what's next. But for now, I'm joined by Chris Thomas, General Counsel for the Arizona School Boards Association. Chris, good morning.
Good morning.
And Matthew Ladner, Senior Advisor of Policy and Research for the Foundation of Excellence in Education. Matt, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Chris, for this moment in time, what does Judge Cooper's decision mean in the practical sense for K-12 schools?
Well, what it means is that really two big things. One is that there will be a reset of the inflation factor moving forward, so that increases from this point forward will be as if those increases were made all along. That's really a critical component for us, and it's going to result in a lot of additional spending on K-12 education in keeping with what the voters intended in 2000.
So how much has the funding shortfall over the past 5 years or so practically affected Arizona K-12 schools?
Well, greatly. I mean, sometimes it's in the decisions that were not made. For instance, raises not given to teachers, or programs that were dropped, class sizes that were increased, or maintenance that was not done on buildings. These are the kind of decisions that over time really erode the system as a whole. Certainly, when it comes to teacher salaries, if we're going to attract and retain the best teachers we can get, we need to be able to offer a competitive salary. And with 85 to 90% of our money that comes through the operations budgets going to salaries, that's really where it hits the hardest.
Matt Ladner, I want to have you comment on that. But before that, what does Judge Cooper's ruling say about how the legislature has prioritized K-12 funding? How complicated has this been?
Well, I mean, I think the key thing to understand is that, you know, if we ask just the general public and we say, do you support additional K-12 funding? People say yes, right? We want our public schools to succeed, and all else being equal, we'd like to spend more. The job of the legislature, however, is to make the numbers work, right? And we do have a number of other priorities for public funding in this state. We have the Medicaid program. We have, you know, courts and jails and roads and everything else. So I think this is a bit indicative of the danger of, you know, sort of budgeting by ballot process, because, you know, you wind up, you know, being unable to anticipate something like what was a very severe downturn in revenues. So You know, that we've sort of muddled through this. Governor Brewer supported a temporary tax increase. When that cycled off, you know, a number of groups that are supportive of public education raised signatures, had their own tax increase, permanent one. Opponents of that successfully made the case to the public that they were sort of skeptical that this was going to see the inside of a classroom, and the voters voted it down. So where that leaves us, I think, now is that if there is going to be this shift into greater K-12 funding, people need to understand it's going to cost us something somewhere else, right? There's no magic font of money coming out of the ground here, like maybe in Texas with oil and gas revenue. So, you know, if we're going to spend more money on K-12, it's going to be less spending somewhere else.
But Matt, does Arizona deserve its reputation as maybe not prioritizing funding for education as much as other states?
I think the reality is that when you compare Arizona to other states, we're fairly modest on the spending side. That's true, okay? However, it is also the case that we spend way more now than we did in previous decades, okay? Arizona is ultimately a fairly poor state, and the wealth that we have in the state is concentrated amongst retirees, many of whom don't pay income tax because they don't spend enough time here per year, right? So I think that there's some big questions we need to address. This is more like a middle-sized skirmish in the grand scheme of things. I think there are much bigger problems coming down the pike.
Chris, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think Matt is being charitable when he says that Arizona is fairly modest in terms of spending on K-12. When you look at the rankings, we end up being 47th or 48th. I know a lot of people say, well, those rankings really don't matter, but they do matter because they have real-world consequences. And you could always say that, well, Arizona is, we have a lot of retirees, we have a lot of low-income wage earners that don't pay a lot of taxes. But, we compound the problem over and over again by we cut taxes here and there, it adds up over time, and then when a bill like this comes due, the legislature turns its pockets over or out and says, we don't have any money. Well, that's only because the menu has been set already. So what we're saying is, it's not our job, obviously. The legislature does have some tough choices to make. We recognize that. And nobody likes to pay taxes. But in the end, we need to pay for the programs that the people seem to want. And what they seem to want pretty clearly is a strong K-12 public education system. And this, they showed that in 2000 when they voted for this, to provide schools a measure of inflation so that they keep pace. And by the way, the legislature put that before the people. So it's not as though it's always been the people against the legislature. The legislature put this before the people in Proposition 301, which was a referendum. The people voted for it, and it's the law. So it's not a question between the legislature and the courts or the legislature. And it's really about the people getting what they voted for. And so we do believe that this is really critical.
Yeah, I don't disagree with a lot of what Chris just said. I would only note that, the last time the public spoke on this, they, at least a large majority of them, seemed to express skepticism that increased funding was going to be resulting in increased classroom spending. I do think there's a path forward here where if we had spending proposals that were clearly going to be tied to, say, improved academic performance. There are a variety of different programs like this around the country. Governor Brewer's championed one here in Arizona. I think that the public support for that would probably be pretty strong. There's a large segment of the population that includes me that thinks that, that view the academic studies on this and just practical experience that there's been large increases in public funding without seeing corresponding increases in student learning.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix with Matthew Ladner and Chris Thomas. We're talking about K-12 education funding in Arizona. Chris, this is hard to quantify, I suppose, but if we look at funding shortfall over the past 5 years, I presume this is not a five-year makeup where Arizona can sort of bounce back within 5 years. Are you concerned that 5 years of shortfall will lead to a decade and a half, where it takes us to really catch up from a practical standpoint?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think there definitely is a compounding problem. And we're actually seeing the compounding problem when we talk about Arizona being 47th or 48th. We're actually talking about the results of a lack of funding that happened during the 90s. Really, before that, Arizona was kind of middle of the pack in terms of funding. So when we go through a period where we don't fund schools and then we get back on board for to funding some measure of cost of doing business increase, we still lose that gap for which we did not provide funding during that period, and that just perpetuates itself over time. And so that's why the voters did vote on the inflationary increase, so we couldn't have those gaps in funding anymore that drop us to the bottom. And they do have real-world consequences. We say that in order to attract and retain the best in any profession, you have to provide a competitive wage. You have to provide that incentive for people to actually go into that profession and stay in that profession. And teaching and good quality teachers are what we need, and this is what this money is all about. It's about providing good quality teachers to deliver high quality programs to Arizona K-12 students.
Matt, are there enough education champions, whether at the Capitol or elsewhere around the state? Because with many things, we hear about it in the world of politics, well, people need to compromise on things. And there are people with very different philosophies about what they think works in K-12, and they may be coming at it equally heartfelt ways. So how do we make that work?
Yeah, it's tough. I think that the big picture here is that there is going to be some funding increases. There have been funding increases in the past, and there will be again in the future. The real problem we have is that, when you take a step back and look at the longer term, by 2030, Arizona will have doubled the number of 65 and older people in this state, and will simultaneously be experiencing enrollment growth in the K-12 system. Our middle-aged taxpayers of the year 2030 are in the public school system right now, and we can look at their test scores right now and see that they're not picking up the type of math and reading skills and knowledge that they need to succeed in life, right? So our biggest opportunity for improving public education in Arizona by a very wide margin is not new money, because there's a limit on how much new money there is. We need to be focusing on ways to get a bigger bang for the buck for the dollars that we already put into the system.
Chris, philosophically, can that work?
Sure, it can work. I think the thing is that we have to quantify what the problem is. And when you look at the data that shows how Arizona is doing and actually in terms of the larger sense of how the country is doing in terms of student performance, where we have the biggest problem is with our at-risk populations. And should we direct those monies to those areas where we really need the most help, I think we will see the greatest bang for the buck academically. Because we have... when we look at our best and brightest students, we compare them to other states and other countries, we do pretty well. But when you look at the lower half, the lower tiers of performance, that's where we're really lagging. And part of that is a function of the fact that we are a very impoverished state, and there's a lot of challenges that kids come to school with. And in order to overcome those challenges, we really have to have the resources to do that.
And English language learning, Matt, I presume, is also an issue here.
It is, and we do have a relatively difficult K-12 population, sort of demographic profile. That's true. It's true that we are modest on spending compared to other states. It's also true that we spend twice as much per pupil as we did back in the 1970s. And it's true we've got a pretty tough nut to crack in terms of our student challenges. All of that is true. So what we need to do is to focus on ways. Look, I mean, Arizona is never going to spend its way to high quality schools. It is not in the cards when you look at just the amount of wealth the state has, what our tax system looks like. It's just not going to happen. It's not clear that even if we tried it would, past experience teaches it would probably fail, right? So that's not the way forward. The way forward for us is to figure out, okay, we can spend $9,000 a pupil or, something like that. That's basically what we can afford if we still want to have a healthcare system and prisons and roads and all the rest of that. Okay. Maybe a little more, maybe a little less. Chris and I can debate that. Okay. But let's say it's $9,000, $9,500, whatever. Okay. What can we do with that $9,500 per pupil that is going to result in more than 40%, not leave 40% of our students illiterate, which is what the NAEP scores tell us right now?
Gentlemen, about a minute left, and I want to come back to the fact that this is an election season. Chris, let me come back to you. Who drives the issue? Who drives the debate on this? Because we saw last night Republican debate over the superintendent of public instruction. There's going to be a general election battle on that in November. How important is that position to driving this debate? Is it still significant? Does it need to be more significant?
Well, it's incredibly significant. I mean, that person has the bully pulpit to advocate for public education. And so, to have somebody there at championing public schools could make a big difference in terms of influencing the legislature, influencing the governor, and ultimately the voters.
Matt?
It is an important position, it by itself is not going to get it done, though. I actually am starting to come to the view that it would be a good idea for the state of Arizona at some point to make that an appointed position.
Interesting.
So that we can.
I don't disagree with that either.
Yeah, we need to have that. Whoever the next governor is, say elected in 2018 or whenever it's going to be, ought to have, no matter who it is, Democrat or Republican, they ought to have a free hand for setting a coherent set of policies to try to improve the public education system of the state of Arizona, in my opinion.
Matthew Ladner is Senior Advisor of Policy and Research for the Foundation of Excellence in Education. Chris Thomas is General Counsel for the Arizona Association of School Boards. Gentlemen, thank you both.
Thank you. My pleasure.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. So what will Governor Brewer and the legislature do? I turn to Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. Hi, Howie.
How's it going? I love the idea of an appointed school superintendent, except that's one less race for me to cover.
Haven't you covered enough races over the years?
These are always interesting philosophical questions. I mean, should a sheriff be elected? Should a county attorney be elected? We don't elect the police chief. We don't elect the city prosecutor. I mean, these are all fascinating questions. I know I'm a little off this subject, but these are larger philosophical questions that go to the whole issue of education and state governance.
Well, Howie, as far as what the governor and Republican lawmakers had to say, because they're basically taking a lot of the blame for this, what are their thoughts about Judge Cooper's ruling, and where do we go from here?
Well, from the perspective of the Republicans, it's those damn activist judges who, once again, infringing on the legitimate decisions made by the legislature. There's a small problem with that, which is that this started off before Judge Cooper ruled. She was directed by the Arizona Supreme Court to decide how much the state was owed when the Supreme Court found out the legislators and the governor hadn't complied with the law. I seem to recall that this governor appointed three of those justices. So it's not like these are some crazy radicals, you know, like they like to portray the Ninth Circuit. Mm. These are her appointees who said the law is clear. The voters said in 2000, you will increase funding by inflation or 2% every year over what it was the prior year. Seems fairly straightforward to me. So
yeah,
in terms of what's next,
go ahead. Mm-hmm.
I think it kind of comes down to they're looking at the possibilities of an appeal. They're looking at maybe whether they can do some technical things make the bill a little smaller, you know, ways to tinker with the funding formula that still leave the state technically in compliance with the law, but do not cost, you know, quite the $313 million in immediate funds that they're talking about.
So what does this do to the state budget? How everyone was sort of celebratory. The session ended fairly early as lawmakers could go run for office again. So where does this put them now, considering more than $300 million needs to be put in quickly, right?
Well, I think the colloquial term is deep kimchi. We've got about $100 million cash carry forward. This wipes that out. Now there is about $450 million, I think, in the rainy day fund. So that would take care of the immediate issue. But you have to remember that if in fact we have to rebase it to what it should have been, had they been complying all along, and keep doing that, an extra $300 million a year for the next 5 years. Plus, the larger issue is, what about the nearly $2 billion that was missed that the district should have gotten? Now, the judge has indicated, maybe I won't make them repay that. But at the very least, we're talking, you know, $300 million this year, $300 million next year, $300 million next year to comply with the law.
Is a special session inevitable then?
Not necessarily. You've got some interesting politics at work. You know, we've got a primary coming up in late August, which means that after August, some of the people who will be voting on this will not be back. And they're going to say, heck, it's not my problem. Special sessions around election are always tricky. You know, you can certainly do one, and we did one years and years ago, I think, on child welfare in December. But it's very tricky in terms of, you know, who cares, who doesn't care, who even shows up. If, in fact, the case goes on appeal, there will not be a decision by the end of the year if we go through full-blown briefings to the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court, so that gives them some time. But that doesn't mean the money goes away. It's not like, well, if we drag it on another year, we'll avoid the $300 million this year. I think it's very clear from the Supreme Court's original order and from what Judge Cooper said, they're going to owe the money. The question is, how quickly do they deal with it, and what decisions do they make?
Howie, whether it's from the superintendent race or some of the legislative races, is this going to be a late campaign issue?
I think it could be more in terms of the governor's race than the superintendent's race, although obviously John Hupenthal said early on after the Supreme Court ruling, let's just settle this, put it behind us, and move on. Diane Douglas is much more conservative in terms of the spending. I don't know that she's specifically addressed exactly how we deal with this court ruling. I think it could be an issue in the governor's race. Obviously, Fred Duval has come out and said, look, let's just comply with the law. It's our children. The Republican candidates have been strangely quiet pretty much in terms of what do we do here, because each of them, with the primary coming up, each is trying to be a little further to the right than the other. Mm-hmm. And nobody wants to be talking about how do we fund this. I mean, there's two ways. You can cut spending elsewhere, and there's not a lot to be cut. I mean, we've cut the universities. Prisons are, if we're going to keep a prison system this large of 40,000 inmates, we've got certain expenditures. What, cut state parks? They're not getting any money anyway. Or you talk about raising revenues, and there isn't a single Republican who wants that T word attached to his or her campaign.
Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. Howie, thanks so much for joining us long distance.
We appreciate it. See ya.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll talk about what's going on with a couple of recent attorneys general in Utah. Why were they arrested yesterday? Also, summer dining has changed a lot in the Valley over the years. We'll find out more from Howard Seftel of the Arizona Republic. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by Stimson Leonard Street. With more than 520 attorneys providing transactional and litigation legal services from 14 offices across the country, online at StimsonLeonard.com.
Good morning. This is KJZZ's Here and Now. Checking temperatures around the state right now, cloudy skies and 70 degrees in Flagstaff. It's sunny and 81 in Prescott, sunny and 90 in Tucson, fair skies and 99 degrees right now in Yuma. In Valley traffic on the State Route 51 southbound, the exit ramp at McDowell Road is restricted. You can show your support for fact-based news coverage by joining the News Isn't Red or Blue campaign and staking a KJZZ yard sign in your front yard. Signs can be picked up at Changing Hands bookstores, Wagon Wash in Scottsdale and Phoenix, and at our Youth Media Center, Spot 127 in Maryvale. A list of locations is at KJZZ.org. Mostly sunny skies, and it's 96 degrees in Phoenix at 11:28.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. Arizona's Attorney General Tom Horn has faced criticism from many sides for a number of months. He's faced multiple investigations for alleged campaign finance violations. His personal life has also been fodder for media and even the FBI. But Horn is still in office and running for re-election. In Utah, the story of the Attorney General's office is much stranger. Yesterday, two recent attorneys general were taken into custody, Mark Shurtleff and John Swallow. With me for a few minutes to explain why is Dennis Romboy, longtime reporter for the Deseret News in Salt Lake City. Hi, Dennis. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. How you doing?
Good. So how long has this story been generating headlines? I would think it wasn't just they got arrested yesterday. It must have been building up for a while.
Yeah, the first headline surfaced really probably around January of 2013, about a week after John Swallow became Attorney General, succeeding Mark Shurtleff, who had served in the office for three terms prior to that.
Yeah, that seemed fairly interesting. That Shurtleff, from outside here in Arizona, we'd heard a bit about him from the FLDS investigations, Colorado City, Arizona, Hilldale, Utah, seemed to have a good reputation. Was this a surprise?
In some ways, there were a lot of stories that were reported kind of over the years with some questionable campaign activities of Mark Shurtleff, particularly with internet marketing industry contributing to his campaign, and just kind of the idea that if they did make those contributions, that they would be looked after if there were any investigation or any attempt to prosecute them or complaints filed against them. That kind of stuff was kind of out there, but it wasn't really fleshed out until the last year or so.
This seems like, from outside again, it seems like a huge bombshell when two very recent attorneys general are arrested. Are things in that office able to sort of still go smoothly, or do people have questions about the current man in office now?
Well, I don't know if they have questions about the current man in office so much as there are a lot of holdovers from the previous two administrations that are still there. The current Attorney General, Sean Reyes, has said that he's reshuffled, reorganized, restructured the office to ensure that these types of things don't happen in the future. But especially his opponent, he's a Republican, he has a Democrat that's running against him, has said that nothing's really changed and there's still a cloud hanging over the office as a result of the activities of the two predecessors. So that's still out there, too.
Well, John Swallow said yesterday that he claims this is political because the district attorney going after him is a Democrat. Has he said anything to back that up?
No, and actually Mark Shurtleff really was really the one who brought that out a lot more than John Swallow.
Okay.
Nothing really specific other than the DOJ looked into this last year and decided to not file any charges against either Swallow or Shurtleff. And so his claim is, well, if they dropped it, why isn't Sim Gill, the Democratic Salt Lake County attorney, dropping it? So this must be politically motivated, and he's just out to get me.
So what's the next step? They were arrested but then released at the end of yesterday. So is there a schedule set up already? Are they going to be sort of keeping quiet publicly, one would think, or no?
I would think so for the next couple of weeks. There will be an initial appearance in court. I haven't seen that scheduled yet. And then there'll be some wrangling in court about discovery and whether the two of them should be tried together or tried separately. So there'll be a lot of proceedings coming up, but I don't think there's anything specifically scheduled at this point.
And when it gets to this level of actually arresting these two former attorneys general, I presume there's no reason to think that the charges will go away?
No, I don't think so. Both of them seem intent on seeing this to a trial. Of course, both of them say that they're kind of been financially tapped out by the investigations, and whether they can afford attorneys all the way through this remains to be seen. And if they can't afford them, there may be some incentive to talk about a plea bargain. And there's some speculation about that, but nothing concrete at this point.
Dennis, my last question for you, I wonder if you could put this in perspective for those of us not in Utah. Arizona's been made fun of by some over the years because it seems like we have some, maybe not scandals, but controversial things that happen. We don't seem to hear as much about Utah. Where does this rank in terms of Utah political or election scandals or elected office scandals?
I think it's unprecedented in Utah. We've had some things over the years with a congressman, some legislators being arrested for DUI or solicitation of a prostitute, that type of thing. But in my recollection, there's never been some office holders or former office holders charged with a total of 21 felonies. I don't think it's ever risen to this level before. This is really unprecedented in the state, especially in recent history.
Dennis Romboy, longtime reporter for the Deseret News in Salt Lake City. Dennis, thanks for the time.
You bet. No problem.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. When Russell Pierce was state Senate president, he was called the de facto governor by some, while others considered him to be the most powerful man in Arizona government. Then a backlash started, and Pierce lost a recall election to Jerry Lewis. And now Pierce is back in the news, as Maricopa County Treasurer Haas Hoskins has offered Pierce a job. That's made some people very unhappy, including my next guest, Randy Padas, who led the successful effort to recall Pierce. Padas is leader of Citizens for a Better Arizona, and the group will be holding a special action at the treasurer's office in about 25 minutes. And Randy Padas joins me now. Randy, good morning.
Good morning.
So did you think Russell Pierce's role in any form of Arizona government was finished?
For the most part, he's 67 years old. He's already collecting on retirement. I think he gets about $51,000 a year on retirement from either his duty as a sheriff and working state government for and as a legislator. We just felt that when you've been, rejected and dismissed so much as he was during the recall and just denounced for his policies and losing the most powerful position of the Senate, that surely he wouldn't be qualified for this type of government job.
Is that what bothers you the most about it?
Well, it's just that when you look at what the little that we do know, one of the reasons we're doing the action day is find out more about this position, find out what was the treasurer's, you know, criteria with the other candidates? What was this, just a behind-the-door thing about a friend giving another friend a job? Because if it involves lobbying, you know, Russell Pierce is one of the most divisive and extreme political figures in Arizona politics. Now, he also has enemies within his own party in terms of a minority of moderate Republicans who don't go as far to the right as he does, as well as Democrats at the legislature. So to hire him on taxpayer money to lobby that body does not make sense for us as taxpayers.
Have you contacted the treasurer's office, and have you gotten any response?
You know, we put calls in, hundreds of people called in yesterday. I left a personal message as well. I have not gotten a call back. But again, this is about accountability and transparency. You know, we believe, and he can, Treasurer Hawkins can tell us differently, that Russell Pierce is not the most qualified person in the state of Arizona to do that particular job. And so if he is, in fact, the most qualified person, we want to see the evidence. We want to see what's going on.
Hey, are you looking into as well whether the job was posted and whether it was sort of given to him behind the scenes?
Absolutely. We want to know, what was the process? Was this something just like inside politics? Russell Pierce is also the first vice president of the Arizona Republican Party. He's very much involved in that type of those types of things, in terms of speaking on issues of, you know, illegal immigration, speaking on, you know, Tea Party politics, and have him come in and be a bureaucrat. And elected leaders of Maricopa County Board of Supervisors, they always talk about, oh, we like to be very pragmatic and not get too involved in whether you're a D or an R. I mean, this is just totally a 180-degree shift. And so we really want to know what's really going down. Is this about pension spiking for Russell Pierce because he wants to, you know, continue on and get a higher salary so he could basically, you know, readjust his pension in a few years? We just don't know what's going on here.
And Russell Pierce also hosts a radio show once a week, I believe, on an AM station as well. So he has his opinions
absolutely.
Out there as well, yeah.
Yeah, and he's still, you know, on the very far extreme wing of the party, and so much so, this is someone who not only lost a special recall election, but when he ran again for the same seat in a Republican-dominated primary, lost by not just a few votes, lost by double digits. So this is someone who's also been just rejected by one of the most extreme red districts in the state of Arizona. So it's just, we're just can't imagine why, when Hoskins is thinking about someone to hire, that name comes up.
Randy, some critics are going to say that, we don't know, obviously, the process. We're going to find that out as well, as you said. What went into this hire? There are going to be some people that say, well, regardless of whether he's old enough to retire, he should be able to take a job if somebody offers it to him. What would you respond?
Yeah, absolutely. He can take a job as offered to him. But we're saying this is not some private company. This is the fourth largest county in the state of the United States. I mean, this is a place where, you know, he's always railing against public funding for public education, public funding for this. He's not going to be on the government payroll again. This is someone who, because he can't even live up to his own values and morals. And so what we're questioning, yes, he has a right to pursue any type of economic opportunity that he wants when it comes to employment. But at the same time, you know, there's a whole bunch of baggage that comes with them. We want to make sure this is not some sort of political patronage payback for some favor Russell Pierce has done for Mr. Hoskins or anyone else in that county, and make sure that we get the most qualified person for that particular job. And I said, based on what we know about Russell Pierce's education, his background, he is not the most qualified person to be managing anything technical or also, you know, implementing or overseeing any type of program or project in Maricopa County.
And Russell Pierce is keeping himself in the news in other ways as well. Yesterday, in the controversy of what was going on in Oracle with the expectation of the bus of child migrants being brought in, he was interviewed on television down at that event. What are your thoughts on that?
Again, he's very consistent in the sense of just being anti-immigrant, anti-Latino, you know, putting out falsehoods about what's really taking place. And so for him to be so engaged in a process for trying to really block refugee children from Central America to come to the United States what's even more interesting, this is actually what our federal government is doing, is actually following the law, what they're supposed to do when people come to the border, especially children, and pretty much turn themselves in. That's the process of law. What they have to do next is, you know, process them, put them in front of a judge and everything else. Russell Pierce wants to obstruct that process. So this is a man full of inconsistencies and contradictions, someone that doesn't have the mental capacity to probably run anything at the Maricopa County government. So we're really concerned what's taking place.
Finally, how far are you willing to go on this?
We'll have to wait and see. We want more information. We didn't know, was there an open process? Was there a job posting? Who were some of the candidates vetted? Was there a national search? What really went down, were any laws violated in terms of, you know, this type of hiring, and exceptions made because of who he was versus what qualifications he had to be, you know, in that particular spot? And what is Hoskins doing contacting people, telling them to apply for these jobs that they're supposed to be posted?
Randy Pata is his leader of Citizens for a Better Arizona. The group is holding a special action at the county treasurer's office at noon today. Randy, thanks for the time.
Thank you.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll talk about summer dining in the Valley. How much has it changed over the years, and what are some trends to watch for? Also, Phoenix Magazine ranked Arizona's governors 1 to 22. We'll find out more about that still to come.
KJZZ is supported by Arizona Watchable Wildlife Experience, launching new audio guides to 17 wildlife sites around Flagstaff, available for streaming and download. Details on what can be seen and heard at azwatchwildlife.com.
Good morning. You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now on 91.5 FM and KJZZ.org. We should see a partly sunny afternoon in the valley today. It'll be a little breezy, and we've got a 10% chance of rain this afternoon and on into the evening. The high should be 106. It'll be cloudy tonight with a low in the mid-80s. In valley traffic on the I-10 eastbound, there's a crash blocking the left lanes at 59th Avenue. And on the State Route 51 southbound, there's a crash on the shoulder at McDowell Road. Stay with us at 12 for NPR's Here and Now. Senator Jeff Flake is saying President Obama's $3.7 billion border proposal needs significant changes. And the number of miscarriages is on the rise as more women are having children at a later age. Here and Now from Boston starts at noon on KJZZ. It's mostly sunny right now in Phoenix and 96 degrees at 11:41.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Summer dining in the Valley has seen some huge changes. It didn't used to be a time to open a new restaurant and try a new concept, mostly because a lot fewer people were around. The winter visitors had left. And with school out, some of the full-timers try to grab a couple of weeks in California or someplace else. So what is the summer restaurant scene like in the Valley now, and what are some trends to look for? To answer those and a lot of other questions, I'm joined by Howard Seftel, Arizona Republic restaurant critic. Howard, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Steve. Glad to be here.
So how long have you been reviewing restaurants in the Valley?
23 years.
Okay, so in those 23 years, this is a big question, what are some things that have changed, especially about dining in the summer?
Oh, well, when I first got here in 1990, literally, you could go to a restaurant, throw a bowling ball down the middle of the restaurant, and, you know, no liability whatsoever. It was dead. I mean, D-E-A-D, dead. One of the things that keeps summer dining going here, of course, are the resorts. Because the resorts can't close. Somebody's staying there. Somebody has to eat there. So they are desperate to put fannies in those seats. And actually, for us here in the Valley, the resorts actually often have nice deals in the summertime. So a meal that could be, you know, $75 to $100 at a fancy resort, they might have a $40 three-course meal to try. So the resorts, for us locals, the resorts are a terrific opportunity that, you know, people are getting on planes and spending thousands of dollars to come here. So it's something we should take advantage of.
You've written some about the resorts in the past, and I don't want to pigeonhole it, but it does sound like some of the changes that have been made are to make them maybe more conventional, less Southwestern, sort of more steakhousey.
Bingo. This was accelerated by the recession, but it actually started before. The notion, sort of an old-fashioned notion of dining, where you would go and sit there for 2.5 or 3 hours and linger over a meal, that's 20th century. And the other component to this is actually interesting in terms of marketing. Let's say you're at a resort for 4 or 5 nights. Well, do you want to eat in this ultra fancy, swanky restaurant 4 or 5 nights? Now, the resorts, you know, want to keep you on property. So if you have a restaurant that's, you know, there's steak and there's fish and there's an Italian dish, you're more likely to come back than if you have a luxurious Mary Elaine's type restaurant where you're going to, you know, nobody dines 5 nights in a row like that. On the other hand, I have to tell you personally, I bemoan the loss of individuality in these resort restaurants. If you remember the old Chaparral Room or Mary Elaine's, these kind of places, you know, you would eat there once a year. That would be the problem, or twice a year.
Right.
But they were fabulous. Can I give you one place that's still sort of like that?
Sure.
Which is a different point of view over at the Point at Tapatio Cliffs. It's perched up on on a butte up there. It's a lovely view, very old-fashioned, but there's a little bit of the old-time swank there.
When we think about some of the trends and some of the things that seem to be picking up as far as Valley dining, summer or otherwise, is there enough of a variety in terms of, and I'm not even talking about off-season, just in general, enough varieties for folks who either are flush with cash or those who are not? Is there enough being offered out there that everyone can try something interesting?
Absolutely. And the reason is, Steve, in the last 25 years, is the explosion of ethnic restaurants here. When I first came here, you know, Mexican, Italian, and Chinese, and really bad Chinese and pretty bad Italian and okay Mexican. I did an article a few weeks ago for the World Cup, about the World Cup. There are 32 teams in the World Cup. Something like 22 of them had restaurants, you know, representative national restaurants here. Okay. And I think I figured there's something like 36 national cuisines here, which is just, if you've been here any length of time, is staggering, because this was perhaps the most white bread town in America, you know, 40 years ago. I have to tell you, I have the Valley's first guidebook, which was published, restaurant guidebook,
okay,
published in the late 70s. It's a hoot. And one of the things they do is, I mean, they had to explain what sushi was. There was a restaurant here, one Japanese restaurant, and it had sushi, and it explained that it's raw fish and it's not for everybody. But don't worry if you don't like sushi, because the restaurant offered a happy hamburger, H-A-P-P-I, with teriyaki sauce, in case you didn't want the sushi.
So not even on the kids' menu. That's...
No, that was for the adults. And, of course, forks and knives.
So how much of an influence has the Midwestern, the folks who come here for the winter, for the cooler months, how much of an influence has that? We talked a little bit about with resorts, but in general, are people who come from other states more adventurous themselves now?
Yes, and I think it's because they're coming from a larger variety of states and situations. Starting in the 90s, you got lots of Californians here, and we started to get more New Yorkers and, of course, more ethnic folks as well. So the foundation is a little more cosmopolitan, and that reflects itself in the eating scene. I wanted to mention something that you alluded to about the summertime and what people are doing in the summer. It used to be that nobody opened a restaurant in the summer, as you suggested, because you're sitting in front of your air conditioning vent until, you know, Columbus Day, because nobody wants to move. But what restaurant owners are finding now, particularly independent restaurant owners, is it's wonderful to open up in May, June, July, and August. And what's the reason? They work the bugs out before the crowds start coming. So, for example, I don't review an ambitious restaurant until it's been open for a couple of months. Well, and I'm not going to really review an ambitious restaurant in the summertime because nobody's here.
Right.
So this way, for both the guests and for the critics, they get a chance to work out the bugs, get their act together. So when October, November rolls around and season starts, they are ready to roll. So you can actually... Well, I would not recommend going to a restaurant right after it opens. You know, after 6 weeks or 8 weeks or so, it'll, you know, at the end of August, it's still going to be empty and you can go in.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix talking with the Arizona Republic restaurant critic Howard Seftel for a couple of more minutes. So we've seen light rail expand.
Yeah.
We've seen more people moving to downtown Phoenix. How could that affect the restaurant scene in the Valley?
Downtown is absolutely the hottest restaurant neighborhood in the Valley, no question. Everyone wants to move there. And the fact that they can't suggests that the landlords are also understand that they're dealing from a position of strength. I will give you one quick example. There's a new restaurant that's opening next week called Mucho Macho Taco. This is a fellow who used to be with Tacos Atoyac over in Phoenix. It's the best tacos in Arizona. And he was looking for a place he was scouring downtown Phoenix. He just could not find a location there. Now, is downtown Phoenix, you know, downtown San Francisco? No. but they're starting to be a convergence. And this was actually starting, Steve, maybe 6 or 7 years ago, and the recession just brought that to a dead halt. And now it looks like momentum is starting up again. If I were a restaurant owner, and believe me, I'm a low-paid journalist, I have no business expertise whatsoever, but I would be looking downtown's the place to be.
Howard, just about a minute or so left, so I put the pressure on for you now. A couple of restaurants that maybe people haven't heard much about, a couple of restaurants that are relatively new, doesn't have to be, that you're excited about.
Well, I haven't been there yet, but here are a couple of new ones. Over in Scottsdale is a place called Sumo Maya. And as you might guess from the title, it has Japanese and Asian and Mexican elements. So there's a Mexican-style Vietnamese soup and Peking duck tacos. That sounds great. Michael O'Dowd, the man who ran Kai for 10 years, it got five diamonds from AAA and 5 stars from Forbes Travel Guide, one of the great restaurants of the country. He left. Now he's opened up a little shop in what used to be the Coronado Cafe in the Midtown Phoenix corridor called Urban Vine. I can't wait to check that out. There's a new restaurant, Steak 44, which is run by the Mastro family, who run Michael Dominic's.
When I was a kid, that was Cork and Cleaver.
Exactly. And let me put it this way. You could have eaten 10 meals at Cork and Cleaver for what it's going to cost you there. But it's a really nice, fun steakhouse.
Howard Seftel, restaurant critic for the Arizona Republic, appears most Wednesdays
right. With
the criticism in there. Howard, thanks for the time.
My pleasure.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. Arizona has had 22 governors in its history since statehood, from the walrus-mustachioed George W. P. Hunt to Jan Brewer.
I understand that some in this chamber and some who hope to try their own hand at this job differ with one or more of these steps. And that's fine, but I have a straightforward message for you. If you have a better plan, produce it.
Maybe you're a fan of Ernest McFarland or One-Eyed Jack Williams or Janet Napolitano.
I think on this issue, he's approaching it as a pragmatist. What is realistic in terms of our country? What is realistic in terms of Arizona?
You may have just moved to Arizona, but you've still probably heard of Evan Meekum, who shocked most when he won in 1986. He lasted barely more than 1 year in office, but what a year it was.
If you continue to push in this manner, and you continue to push people who have willingly said, we want equal rights for all people, the time does come when the majority says, we're not going to take it anymore.
Phoenix Magazine editor Craig Outier, with the help of Arizona historians Marshall Trimble and Jack August, compiled a ranking of the 22 governors. Meekum came in last, by the way. Outier says, as with former presidents, historians can change their viewpoints on governors after they've been out of office. He says that's been happening with Fife Symington.
No one's rehabilitating Evan Meekum. That just wasn't happening here. But both Marshall and Jack have a high opinion of Fife Symington, who they both felt was just a really skilled administrator, had a good value system that appealed across the aisle, and maybe was too much of a wheeler and dealer, which really, you know, was his undoing. Mm-hmm. But a charismatic guy who brought people together and got things done, an effective administrator. So he was number 5 on our list.
How high did they decide to rank folks based on bipartisanship, the idea of working both sides of the aisle?
Sure.
Did that come up?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's really the only way to get things done in a real way. And so, yeah, that was a big metric for both of them. The bottom half of the list is just filled with governors, for instance, Raleigh Stanford, who governed during the Depression. Mm-hmm. Great. He was a brilliant lawyer. He was a chief justice in the Arizona Supreme Court. Later, he just could not collaborate. He just wasn't in his DNA. Raul Castro, our first Hispanic governor, mm-hmm. the nation's first Mexican-American governor, doesn't rank very highly because he was a lawyer who was and a great ambassador, called his own shots, ran a great mission, didn't know really how to collaborate.
And it must be hard to rank guys who are not in office very long. Obviously, there's Raul Castro's successor.
Sure.
Didn't last very long, which led to Bruce Babbitt, which is also mentioned there. It's also, we had three governors in the span of, a year and a half or so?
Yeah, it was just a whirlwind of secessions. And the one you mentioned is Wesley Bolin, who was the Secretary of State for several decades. Mm-hmm. Beloved guy, ex-sheriff, Probably didn't want to be governor. Probably was very happy being Secretary of State for the end of until the end of all time. But you know, here in Arizona, no lieutenant governor. Mm-hmm. If you're Secretary of State and the sitting governor happens to leave for any reason, that's you. So the poor guy took office, and then there was this flooding disaster in the valley in the late 70s. And Marshall Trimble theorized that it was just too much for him, the stress, and he died of a heart attack in his house during the flooding.
You've got Mofford and Hull, who had really different perspectives on that, too. Mofford's another one who didn't seem to really want to be in the office.
No, I don't think so. And she's such a great story, and obviously beloved here in Arizona. You know, I don't think she did want to be governor. I think she, you know, she started off as a pool secretary at the Capitol, kind of worked her way up, was elected Secretary of State. The first time she was Secretary of State was when Raul Castro left. But because she wasn't elected to that office, and she just came in and filled the previous Secretary of State, Wesley Boland, she couldn't take the governorship. So it went to Bruce Babbitt, like you say. She was perfect for Arizona at the time. She was this kind of soothing, maternal figure after Evan Makem.
How do we measure whether someone is good or bad? Right. That's why the ranking's got to be really difficult when it comes to
this thing. Yeah. A lot of it's subjective, you know, and I wouldn't say it's a popularity contest by any means. Longevity was a big part of it. If you can get reelected, and, you know, for instance, our first governor, George Hunt, was elected, I believe, six different times before they had term limits. You had to almost put him in the top six just based on that alone. And he wasn't a great bipartisan collaborator by any means. But, yeah, I think being able to defy people's expectations, bend a little bit from time to time was a big part of it, and get the big projects done that define Arizona, like, you know, I'll just say our number one guy was Sidney Osborne, not a household name by any means in Arizona, but the single governor most uniquely responsible for getting the Colorado River Compact done, which helped Arizona grow into the state we know now. So he was our number one guy, and actually both Jack and Marshall put him in their top two. So he was an easy guy to put up.
And your number two was Bruce Babbitt, another guy who was really well known for working with both sides of the aisle and doing big things as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, water was a big part of his governorship. You know, he was kind of like a closet technocrat. I mean, he was a lawyer. Mm-hmm. He was the attorney general. But water was his thing, and he understood it. And he created policies that resonated across the country. Part of the reason he became Secretary of the Interior later on, you know, he just had a real talent for that. We kind of lost him. He kind of became a Washington guy, you know, once you become a cabinet member. Arizona really can't claim you anymore.
I'd be remiss if I didn't mention Sam Goddard, only because his son Terry has won a lot of elections, but he's lost every time he's run for governor.
Right.
And yet Sam Goddard was pretty low on the list. Anything significant stand out about him?
Yeah, I mean, he was kind of ahead of his time. He was a fully functional modern Democrat in that, you know, he embraced the Civil Rights Act. He wasn't an old states' right Democrat by any means. Mm-hmm. But he couldn't... you know, he wasn't bipartisan in the slightest. And I think back then, Arizona, even though it was still predominantly Democrat, people sometimes don't realize this was a Democrat-dominated state through its first, you know, 50 years. Those were conservative Democrats, by and large, especially outside of the city. Yeah. So he had a 1-2-year term back before, you know, governor served a 4-year term here. Mm-hmm. And you just can't, you know, with a 1-2-year term, he just, I don't think either Jack or Marshall felt like he could be ranked higher than, you know, in the teens.
Was there any comparison as to where Arizona governors rank? Is it a pretty good group?
Yeah, I think it actually is a good group. The office itself is what's traditionally been marginalized. It was always a very weak office up through the 60s. It kind of changed that, you know, policy was rewritten to make the governor less of a rubber stamper, but that was something that kind of held back a lot of the governors. The power was really in the legislature for a long time. As far as the substance of the people who have held the office, I mean, we have some interesting facts. We've had the most female governors, four. A lot of diversity, a lot of people who have gone on to big things nationally. I think the stock of our governors is pretty high. It's something we can be proud of.
Craig, anything we missed?
Well,
tales or any fun stuff we missed?
There was one governor who ran on an interesting slogan, ugliest man in Arizona, which I don't know if it would play well today. His name is John C. Phillips.
Was that pre-TV days?
It was pretty...
So he didn't even have to say anything about
exactly,
that.
Exactly, really. That wouldn't come back to haunt you.
Craig Uttier, the editor-in-chief of Phoenix Magazine. Craig, thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
That's all for today's edition of KJZZ's Here and Now. Thanks very much to Sarah Ventry and Bruce Drummond, and thank you so much for listening. I'm Steve Goldstein. NPR's Here and Now is next on listener-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD.